we've always loved horror. It's just that horror hasn't always loved us.
Black people play a particular role in horror films.
First, we weren't in it. We were played by white people.
Yeah.
We went from maids to pimps and hoes.
If there was somebody black, they would be the first to die.
Black films hold a mirror up to society, but at the same time give an audience an escape.
One fellow said to me, you were directing before it was legal.
You can be the boss down there. I'm boss up here.
Yes, that's history.
We've shifted from being the focal point of the fear to being the heroes.
This would be unheard of 25 years ago.
If we can use what we've experienced, we can tell stories that people have never seen before.
Welcome back, listeners.
Yes, welcome back.
And we'd like to welcome Christina Leith Mallon.
Hey, guys.
Welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you on here. You're going to teach us all the things.
Whoa, that's no burden at all. What things do you want to know?
No pressure.
Yeah, so I know Christina from the New York Horror Meetup Group. We've got some friends in common, and we've been getting to know each other. And last February, she presented a piece from her documentary, My Final Girl, about a study of black women in American horror. So I got a look at some of what you've been working on, and you have been at work between the MFA projects and the films and the papers, and we're going to talk all about it.
That sounds awesome. I'm totally down. It's been a long journey, but I'm really excited. And it's coming too, so yeah, right on.
Yeah, and so speaking of, your website is fantastic.
MyFinalGirl.com
is full of collections of movies, lists of actresses, interviews that you've done, and including your video podcast, which, yeah, it was a lot of fun to go through and kind of take notes and keep track of.
Aww. Yeah, it's this kind of like great repository of all things black women and horror. And the journey is a long journey that started with just media studies and then wanting to do my MA. And kind of when you get into graduate school, you realize you're going to get in bed with a subject, so you have to make sure you really love it. And so I was like, I love all these lofty artsy things, but could I make horror like a thing? And then I realized, oh, it is a thing. So I was like, yeah, I can get in bed with that for the next 2, 3, 4 years. And so, yeah. And then kind of because I'm a feminist at heart. I think we all are, man, woman, child, pumpkin. And I was like, how do I incorporate the feminist thing with the horror thing, with the graduate thing? And come to find out, it really does roll out as such. And so I started researching a bunch of PhD scholars that did this stuff. And I'm giving you like the whole spill, but so my MA was a study on French horror, the new wave extremities. And so, you know, Haute Tension and L'Intérieur and Martyrs. And it was like perfect timing that I was studying that when that was the French horror craze. And I did Objectification Repackaged, the women of 21st French century French horror. And that was kind of a canvas of horror from like Grand Guignol and Marquis de Sade all the way up to this. And long story short, when I carried on to my MFA, I was like, how do I make it personal? And I think I told you the story about how I was like trying to catch up on old 80s horror during my daughter's nap time, because I used to get 2 naps on my kid. And that was like the quick moment where I didn't have to watch Cat in the Hat. And I was watching Basket Case, which I had never seen before. And she woke up. She's like 2-something. She woke up from her nap super early. And she came just as like the hideous thing was killing the dentist. And she's like, spooky bug! ass kid and started screaming. And I was like, oh, epic fail as a mom. And I was like scrambling. The way you scramble to put your clothes on when you get caught having sex, that's the way I was with the remote trying to turn off the video. And I was like, oh.
You're like, this is not Baby Shark.
No, it isn't. It is not at all. But then it was like, it made sense. You, when you do stuff, you know, you want to make sure you have a legacy. Like, when I die, what will I be known for? Like, working at McDonald's or biting my nails. So I was just thinking, like, hey, I'll leave a legacy for her. And I didn't even think about it because I was like, I did French women. Should I do Asian women? Should I do Italian women? What should be my next thing? And I was like, why not Black women? Especially here in the U.S. because they're like, Black people are the first to die. So I was like, can I find Black women in horror? And so that was like how this all started to come to.
Cool. So I wanted to ask you about that process in terms of when you started researching, when you kind of took it on as a subject to dive into. So like for me, watching horror noir and kind of taking notes, there were a number of things that like, oh yeah, elements that you pick up subtlety as you watch it. Sometimes it's subtext, sometimes it's in the forefront. But when you were doing research, were things starting to click into mode that like, oh yeah, I do have all this frame of reference?
Yes and no. I would say with My Final Girl and with horror noir, we don't watch these regularly. Right now, if you go to friends and you say, name two Black horror movies from the 70s. First thing you're going to hear is Blackula.
Yeah.
And then everyone's going to be stumped for number two. You know, they'll be like, oh, what? Pam Grier was in Foxy Brown. I literally went to a horror conference and they're like, well, does Foxy Brown count? And I'm like, you can't just use Pam Grier as your go-to. There were other, you know, and that's the whole, to your question, I think a lot of people don't know about it. Like, you know, you guys know Abby or Sugar Hill because you're a horror person. But if you're not a horror person, you don't know the bigger collection of horror that have Black people or have women in them, you know. Sure. You just kind of know the base theories. Like, everyone knows The Final Girl because, yeah. Well, I know her first because of Carol Clover, which is the book Man, Woman, and Chainsaws that it was based on, but now they have The Final Girl movie and The Last Final Girls, and so now it's this trope, and now there's a Final Girl book written by a guy, which is ironic, and it's I'm plodding through it.
We've ran out of Final Girls. We hit the final, and now we're moving on. We're back to men.
Well, here's the crazy thing. Like, he keeps saying in the book, they keep calling me the Final Girl. I guess I'm the Final Girl. And I'm like, he plays so to the trope of the name that it's just... But that's the thing. This is... We're just now starting to accept this as part of the culture. But if you're not a horror fan, you don't know half of the titles that I know. And I feel like I only came to them because I was studying them. I had never seen Abby. I had never seen Sugar Hill. I've seen Blackula. I've seen Scream, Blackula, Scream. But I hadn't seen as much as when I began to do the research. And then I thought to myself, like, it's great for me to do the research and put a book out there. But because, to your question, that a lot of people don't know, make a little database so people can go back to it. And I don't know everything, so I said, please share with me things that I've missed. Like, Ganja and Hess was a huge movie that when I saw it, I, like, my jaw dropped. I was like, wait, we have high art Black horror in the 70s and no one told me about this? So, you know, it's about getting it out there and then keeping it out there. Not everyone's going to want to sit up and read a book, but if I make a really fun, cool, interactive database that grows... it becomes a Wikipedia for Black women in horror, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I think, though, even in the horror community, I think a lot of people don't know a lot of Black horror. And especially if you say, okay, well, name a Black, like, Final Girl, someone's going to say Demon Knight. I mean, I think probably that's the first thing you would...
They might not even, but yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to latch on to.
Yeah, and I think it's something that is kind of interesting because... I think in the horror community, it's a very small community. It's a very tight community, but it's still something that's not out there for everyone. Like, unless you go out and dig for it, it's not in your face like some other kind of things are.
Yeah.
Like, even Latin horror, I would say, is more prevalent than, I would say, Black horror.
Yeah. It's funny. Horror gets relegated to sort of, you know, peripheral status. Most people aren't into it. And then to go into an even smaller subset that has existed, you know, going back to the early 1900s, but just hasn't gotten the attention, certainly mainstream attention.
Yeah,
but,
I think
that's kind of why we're talking
about. One of the things, though, and I had mentioned it to you last week, and I wondered if you had taken any time. It's not exactly horror. It's macabre. 59's Black Orpheus, the Afro-Brazilian film, is one that I think is a big, huge basis for a lot of black horror elements or themes. And something like, certainly like Us or the stillness that comes from Get Out, it reminds me of that kind of film. Mm.
See, I totally am down. Now I'm writing that down because I want to look that up because I've not watched that title either.
And it's not horror, but it's got macabre elements to it. It's mystical. It's a love story at heart, but a lot of horror actually is a love story.
Sure.
In the macabre aspects of it. And I think that's one of those films where that's an art film. That's something that no one thinks about, but there it was, 1959.
Cool. Yeah, that go on my list too.
But I'm going to warn the listeners, it's not horror, it's tragedy and it's macabre.
Well, here's the thing, too, that I kind of frame, if you go to my website and history, and I'm trying to build that out to a better book. So I'm basically trying to turn my MFA thesis into a book. But there, up until, I want to say, the 2000s, there were three main pockets of black horror. And that was kind of the bigger overarching idea, not just me spotting a few titles, but there were the 1930s race horrors, which it wasn't really a horror genre, but there were two sets of cinema. There was Hollywood cinema or Edison or 1920s cinema, and there was black cinema, whereas there were more cautionary tales that went from church to church to church in caravans. And a few of those titles, the two main people you know are Oscar Michaud and Spencer Williams, but they each had a couple of... What they would do is try their hand at a Western, try their hand at a religious, try their hand at a horror. So there wasn't a whole genre per se, but there were like The Blood of Jesus and Son of Ngagi and these films that kind of had your gorillas, your monsters, but they were black films with black characters at the center, and they weren't mammies that were hanging on to the white. So that was what I call race films. And then, of course, we're in the 70s with, like, Abby, we talked about, the Blackula, Ganja and Hess. And then the 80s, which you mentioned, I feel like it's 80s and 90s, that's Vampire in Brooklyn, that's Demon Night, that's Death by Temptation, right? And so that's kind of where when I started this process, that's what I was looking at. I had 1, 2, and 3, and I added on a new phase of horror, which is, of course, Jordan Peele doing the socio-psychological horror, because his two films are African-American centric. Their protagonist is African-American. The concept of what they're dealing with is germane to the African-American experience. So I feel like he's ushering in this new kind of high art black horror phase. So I'm like super excited about that. And it gets tapped on with horror noir, which is crazy because I actually interviewed Dr. Robin Means Coleman and spoke on it about her book. And she was talking about my work with my stuff too, like a few years ago before this even got going. But it's like amazing the kind of idea that horror is taking off as such.
So one of the early ideas that comes up in horror noir, and we'll dive into that in a minute, but is the idea that American history kind of serves as black horror, and by that measure, it's kind of all about perspective.
The Birth of a Nation was a horror film, especially if you were a black person.
Most people at that point were getting to know what African Americans were like through that film, because they lived in communities where they had no African Americans. This was the only source of information, and a lot of people got the wrong impression of who we are, certainly.
It's one of the first films to be screened in the White House, in Woodrow Wilson's White House.
Didn't help that Woodrow Wilson said that's exactly the way it is.
Oh, you know, I mean, he was a contributor to the problem.
With the endorsement of the president, it feels like policy. There were even advertisements and promotions that said this was essentially based on a true story, and it was as close to fact as one could get.
The Ku Klux Klan is being heralded as the solution to the black menace.
This is a movie that really solidifies that there's this sort of odd black lust on the part of black men towards white women. You see it time and time again, then throughout the horror genre, from King Kong to Candyman.
It reigned as the picture of black life for so many years. Hollywood could use its messaging to create fear around black people, especially fear around black men.
It sets up black life and culture as so deficient and so deviant. And I think we see that kind of history informing race relationships even today.
And so we've already talked about The Final Girl, and, you know, there are a whole generation of fans watching young women get chased by killers. And, you know, men or women were watching that and were empathizing. And then there's still this kind of hurdle of introducing black characters and sort of having black film accepted into the mainstream. And I don't know, maybe it's a little early to sort of dive into this idea, but I kind of feel like as racist as America is and can be, I don't think it's nearly as racist as Hollywood thinks it is when sort of choosing projects to fund, you know, choosing, you know, the idea that Jordan Peele is a black filmmaker, got to direct and produce his own film. Like it's been a long time. Like you were saying, it goes back to the 1920s since there was like a black driven film industry.
When I found out they were going to let me actually direct Get Out, I knew something big was going to happen. I thought there was a chance something very bad could happen, that I would get run out of town, that, you know, I thought there's a possibility that people, you know, don't want to see entertainment about something that, you know, has been traditionally dealt with a certain reverence. But I also thought, you know, this is the movie I wanted to see.
I'm excited at the direction things are going, where the idea of like, oh, well, the public can empathize with the black main character. That's not such a big deal. Like, they've proven it. They've shown up at the box offices. They've paid their money. Sorry, there's not really a question in there, but if you've got a response.
No, I think you tapped onto two different things. And I'll address them separately. The idea of the industry and then the idea of characterization in films. So in regards to the industry, we've come a long way, but like I said, Oscar Michaud, Spencer Williams, they were your first sets of like black filmmakers that have black centric things. And the problem is there is a, let's say, a black industry and a white industry. That's the way our society set this up. So yes, you had King Kong and Fay Wray, but you know, all of your subsequent African-American cast or others cast are always kind of deemed, if you look at the credits, they're all uncredited. The only people that had credits are the Caucasian actors. And so it was kind of black cinema was speaking to, hey, we want our representation there. And then with the 70s, that was a mishmash that Jordan's actually, you know, gone past, which is a lot of the black productions that we saw, like we keep referencing Sugar Hill, all this, that was actually white money wanting to get a quick and dirty grindhouse movie to get butts in the seat. It wasn't they cared about the black experience. The only film that I honestly will stand 100% beside and say it did was Ganja and Hess, because that was a predominantly black crew and cast. So it was a black experience piece. All of the rest were quick and dirty grindhouse. So again, that was white industry putting the money forth to perpetuate what they thought the black stereotypes of you mean, I love William Marshall as Mamoru, but you know, let's just be honest. He was playing the part. He has gravitas, you know, but it was a caricature of Dracula. And even at the top of it, he meets Dracula and Dracula, you know, does him wrong and he's put away with his wife forever. So, you know, that is. And the same thing happened in the 90s. There were still two different things. Demonite and Vampire in Brooklyn. I love Wes Craven, God rest. but those were white-centric films that had a black person. Versus Death by Temptation, which was a black film about black experience. So again, and like I'm not going to say I'm like the end all on this. A lot of this is in horror noir, where as Robin Mean Coleman, we had a great conversation talk about black films and films with black people, which are two different things. And so that, so when we look at Jordan Peele, as in, you saw it in horror noir, he has the money. He already has the name power and now the money, because Get Out, I think, only got $5 million. And because it was such a hit, it's a numbers game. He got $20 million. Right now, he's at $200 million gross on his 20. So his return is beautiful. So he doesn't matter what he does next. He's got the star power. He's got the money. So he can make that. But that isn't to say that any other black person could do that. You couldn't just come out of nowhere and do that, you know? So, and then going back to the other thing about the history of blacks and the characters, it's problematic because of the fact that blacks came to here as slaves. And even in media, it started off, now we're talking like the characters, they didn't start off in the right path. The fact that we had to do two separate cinemas because we weren't being represented right. And even Spencer Williams, when he got to like the back in the day Jordan Peele level of success, then he started doing Amos and Andy, which is a caricature, right, which a lot of people gave him backlash about. So, and that's what I found too, when we specifically talk about women, your final girls, have you guys read any of the theory on Final Girl, Carol Clover?
I've read a good bit of Men, Women, and Chainsaws. Yeah.
Yeah. So the whole idea of the final girl isn't that she's strong. It isn't that she's amazing. It's that we strip her of her femininity. We give her some type of pseudo boyish name. We give her a boyish body. She's not like the cheerleaders. She's the most keen, but she's the most like a young male. So we accept that, or the male culture accepts that. And Men, Women, and Chainsaws is more about saying how men themselves can't handle their feminine side. So we must defeminize women in order to let them be equal or heroes in the genre.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the even more ironic part about that is the reason why we don't really talk about black female final girls is because black women historically have been sexualized, like big butt, big boobs. So it's harder to put her in that boyish, masculine framework if we see her as this voluptuous creature.
It makes sense even with the costuming. Take it back to Demon Knight, and you see the way that they costume Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yep.
And there's a sexuality to her, but the sexuality almost comes from the masculinity.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because she's in like the plain white tank. It's very
short hair.
Yeah. Short hair.
Her name's Geraldine. Geraldine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's tough. I have a question for you about kind of going back to this kind of separation with black cinema, or the like race films versus black people in white cinema. And I was watching, Nacho Vigalondo has this short film right now on Hulu called Pooka. It features a black actor, but never once is it important or mentioned that he's black. He just happens to be a black guy. And similarly to Dwayne Jones, right, in Night of the Living Dead, in that he just happens to be a black guy who's wandered through the scene. And I was wondering, is there sort of, you know, for women, we have this Bechdel test to say women in cinema, they're completely autonomous, essentially.
Yeah, whether they're serving the plot or actually autonomous characters.
Right, right. And so is there something like that that we could think of for you know, black characters that either wander in or just happen to be there without, like, saying, that's a black guy, like, because we see him, we know.
No, that's a great question. You know what? Okay, let's first start with men, because the Bechdel test, we all know that, like, have a whole scene with just women, talk about women, don't need any men. It's funny, because I saw a follow-up to the Bechdel that was talking about minorities, and it's like, can we have two black guys talk about black stuff? And I'm like, wait, why is it gotta be guys? You know, right. And I was just like, okay, you just lost your point there. But the thing is with Night, I love the fact you brought up Night of the Living Dead, and Dr. Coleman has brought that up too in her work. And it was one of the things that resonated with me most. Dwayne Jones, he was also in Ganja and Hess. I love him. He was also a teacher in New York. He's just everything to me. But he was his character. And as you guys know, I'm pretty sure, because you guys are the best, that was purposeful. If you read her book, Dr. Robin Means Coleman, I think she mentioned the movie, and if she didn't, I know I when I talked to her, she mentioned that Night of the Living Dead resonated with her the most because her grandmother or her mother lived there. They knew the very ending, you know, when they shoot him.
Yeah.
That was a real cop that really worked there. And she said something about that for one of her, either her grandmother or her mother or aunt. It resonated because they knew that that scene shook out very truthful, that he was a bit of a racist in that town. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so when he got to play that, and it wasn't random that he shot it. It was very much, because that was shot in 1968 with the race riots, you know, that were happening across. So George Romero really wanted to say, you know, how horrible we are as humans that we didn't even stop to say, are you okay? So, and that was a real statement. And right now in university, because I know we actually studied that, and it wasn't because of my major, but it was actually studying university, how race relations really shake out in genres. My biggest problem, I even saw this with Captain Marvel, with her best friend, when Captain Marvel was having a moment where she can't remember anything, and the best friend, who's African-American, says, but you are this, and you are this. It reminded me of the help. You is wise. You is smart. Whenever you have an African-American that has to reinforce to a Caucasian how wonderful they are, you've just shut down the movement in my eyes. Because, you know what? I could say, Darren, you're wonderful, you're this, but I feel like Hollywood depends on it too often as to have that Morgan Freeman narrator voice coming from. It could be a black person. It could be an Asian person that has to promote the qualities of the white person. That's automatically you've lost me. So far as women, I check out when you make the assumption that the most boyish character is the smartest of the bunch. That's when I check out. You know, I hate that. So if I see this girl with Jenny McCarthy boobs, Cabin in the Woods rocked my world because all of them, the hottie was smart, her hottie boyfriend who was Thor, he was smart. And I was like, there we go. I'm on board, you know, and the pothead was brilliant. I'm on board, you know, because it's breaking stereotypes. You know, you can be sexy and smart. You know, you can be a pothead and spur. I don't know. Those are the traps. The Hollywood traps are anything that takes any of your qualities away. If I take your qualities away, Darren, as a man, because you need to tell her how wonderful she is, on the reverse, that's wrong. That's reverse, you know, feminism. It's all about, let's just, I don't know what the word is. I just know that I can spot it in a second when someone's bleeping up.
Yeah, there's that moment in horror noir, and you'll have to forgive me, I can't remember the actress's name, but she was the black actress in The Craft, and she's talking
Rachel
about
True.
Serving that... Rachel True?
Yep.
Back when I was doing The Craft, I definitely was really nervous about how to portray this character, like Bonnie has burns, or what's her name? Sarah has scars, and the other one is poor and very angry and probably bipolar, right? So when I first auditioned, I had a big monologue about being anorexic. And then I think once they decided to cast me, that is when they made race her issue. But for me, I was like, I don't have an issue. I didn't think it was a big enough problem for her to have. Although in retrospect, I actually think it's fantastic they had it in, because that is the kind of racism, whether it was subtle or big, that I went through, I'm sure you went through, and everyone went through. But isn't it interesting that I was able to compartmentalize it and be like, what, she doesn't have a problem? Because that's so ingrained in me that that's a part of me that I'm going to go into a store and someone's going to be horrible to me, or somebody white's going to say something terrible.
Why are you doing this to me, Laura?
Because I don't like Negroids.
to this day, people come up to me and tell me how much it meant. I was getting off a train, this little girl was getting on, and she went, you're the Kropf movie. And I realized, oh, I wasn't even thinking that, like, I'm now in a movie, so these girls don't have to go through what I did, which was, you know, watching Pretty in Pink and going, there's no one who looks like me or acts like me or sounds like me. I am going to be that for these girls.
Well, you know what? I just realized, too, as, like, think of it in a filmmaker sense, any character that you're like, oh, Bechdel test, see how developed out their backstory is. That's when you know they didn't develop that character, but it was just there to serve someone else.
On the note of going back to Night of the Living Dead, I didn't realize until recently, like, actually, when you presented Ganja and Hesh at the Women in Horror event in February, I didn't realize Dwayne Jones had been in another movie aside from Night of the Living Dead. Even doing the research for that episode that we did, you know, he auditioned for the part. He was the best guy who auditioned, and he got the part. And from then on, I thought he was just teaching acting.
Because he's a teacher.
New York. But then finding that he went on to be in Ganja and Hess is kind of beautiful. But going back to the idea of his role in Night of the Living Dead, as good as the movie is, I think it is historically greater than the sum of its parts. And the fans have a lot to do with that. The historical circumstance of 1968 has a huge amount to do with that. But also the idea that, like, at its heart, it was a meritocracy where, like, the best actor got the part.
Right.
And, like, that's kind of what, you know, any real piece of art should be striving for. To transition into talking about horror noir, the documentary specifically, so it came out earlier this year. It's now a Shudder exclusive. It was directed by Xavier Bergen, and it's based on the book by Robin Means Coleman. And the synopsis, you could probably surmise already by the discussion, but it describes it as a look at the history of black horror films and the role of African Americans in the film genre from the very beginning. And it starts out with the punch. It starts out with Get Out. It's still kind of on the wave of success that Get Out had, with Jordan Peele winning the Oscar for Best Screenplay. And it was nominated for other things. So it was Daniel Kaluuya. That was kind of a feat. But on that same note, it starts on a very, socially familiar note. When the movie opens and it is a black guy in a white suburb who is just like, we're hearing his inner monologue, he's on the phone, he's kind of thinking out loud, and it's, you know, it's very much the Trayvon Martin scenario. It's any scenario that we've been hearing from the news in terms of, like, black people in white spaces, and then, you know, it's a meme, it's a police report, it's a shooting, and, like, off the bat, we are through the looking glass.
Here's the thing. When horror noir and the Get Out entrance, it was really important. I feel like right now, there are certain movements, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, Time's Up, and there are a lot of raw emotions, but these things have been, like, decades. They've been bubbling for a long time. It's just we have a more openness to talk about them direct. You know, yes, horror cinema. You know why that's so wonderful? Because horror cinema is relegated to, I don't do that. So when you have your George Romero's to do Night of the Living Dead, realize he wasn't a big Hollywood director with hundreds. He was an independent guy making a zombie flick in a local town in Pennsylvania. It was pretty low budget. So you or I right now, we go and make a movie, a horror movie, and we have a very strong message. We have liberty to do it because we're not famous Hollywood directors. There's no, like, well, GE is one of the financial backers, so you can't do that. You can't do that. Apple wants you to put the logo right here. You don't have any of that. You just have your truth and the best actor. Not, oh, you have to cast that person because it's producers, girlfriends, blah, blah, blah. But you get the Dwayne Jones. You get to tell your truthful message. And I feel like right now what's going to be telling is the next step for Jordan Peele. Mm-hmm. Or the next film. Because right now the Twilight Zone is the next step. But so Get Out was amazing. $5 million budget. and he snuck his vision, because there weren't a lot of people on his radar. Blumhouse let him go. Blumhouse, you know, there weren't a lot of people on the radar telling him what to do, what not to do. Then they gave him a little bit more money. Now he's like a green light king. He can do whatever, but he's going to get seriously scrutinized, and he's going to have a lot more constraints because a lot more money is going to be invested in him, because he's going to be considered a payday. So the idea is, next film, will he get to politically go anywhere he wants, or will we start to see that get refined because of how big he becomes?
Yeah, I've been kind of playing that out. Just I saw Us in the theater. I saw it twice. I saw it with the meetup group on Tuesday.
I haven't seen it yet. If you spoil it for me, I'm going to beat you guys. I'm going to get really mad if you guys spoil it, so don't you dare. If I need to check out, I will check out.
But I think, so going, Christina, to what you were saying before in terms of, I'm not going to give any spoilers, Mindy.
I'm watching you.
Us, I thought, kind of opened up the dialogue to be far more broadly social commentary.
Agreed. 100%. Yeah.
It's part of the reason it was as quick. Well, I think there was also a lot of hype, but I think it was also like a very quick success. Like those first opening weekends were huge.
Well, and the posters are everywhere. It's just everywhere.
Yeah, I passed them on Grand Central still.
It's kind of nice to see, like, think about this. Something that was tried and true, a successful story that everyone knows, Pet Sematary, is coming out the same time, really, as Us. And yet, I didn't see one poster for Pet Sematary, but Us is everywhere. And you see this, you know, like, smiling, happy, like, black family posters everywhere. And something like Pet Sematary, which you'd think the studio would say, like, I know I'm going to at least make my money back. Let's throw up a couple posters. And I didn't see any. And so how amazing that they're trusting Jordan Peele with this money.
Well, here's the thing, too. With Pet Sematary, it's a catch-22. We're talking Stephen King. We're also talking, it was, like, phenomenal, but The Dark Tower tanked. So I think they're kind of like, this could go one of two ways. And then you have Jordan Peele coming off of a hit, and then I don't know if it's a tribute to marketing, but you remember how secretive, like, he's got a new project. We all knew it was buzzing. We were buzzing when we saw the first butterfly effect of Lupita Nyong'o, the black and white poster. Mm-hmm. We're all like, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean? There were people doing all kinds of conspiracy theories months before this came out in preparation. And then when the first trailer, you don't know how many deconstructed, let me explain all the Easter egg videos were on YouTube just about the trailer. And I was like, dude, we don't even know what the movie's about yet. And it was kind of like a testament to the marketing, I think, too.
Yeah, I mean, Darren and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago about the ads and the posters and everything. It reminded us of the old days of American Horror Story, when you still looked forward to that and they would show you the ads and they would give you little tiny Easter eggs here and there and here and there. And that's what it reminded me of, because I'm like, oh, well, the scissors and this. And, you know, I love that. And to re-energize the horror genre in this day and age is really difficult. But then also to have, you know, like a black filmmaker who's a comedian at heart, I think, a comedian, like, really re-energizing it is amazing.
Yeah. And also to realize, like, that was where my first point was leading. There was a hit and a miss with the recent Stephen King's. Right now, there hasn't been a miss with Peele.
Right.
So, you know. And I think one of the biggest takeaways when I saw it, and when I first saw it, was I was walking in there like, okay, you did Get Out, and it was so Black Lives Matter. I was scared as a black person that it would be another heavy-handed white on black versus black situation. So I was ridiculously, I feel, and there must have been other people who felt the same way, pleasantly surprised that you're right, Darren. It was more a bigger social point than being a them versus us situation. Well, it was a them versus us. But you know what I mean? It wasn't a black versus white situation. And I think that was another testament to Jordan Peele's, like, I'm going to talk about black narratives, but they're just going to be like any narrative. If I talked about a Spanish narrative, it's about the story. And just because I'm a black filmmaker doesn't mean everything I do is going to be about the oppression of blacks or the sadness of blacks or the taunting of blacks. This was, he told a big story. He still had a African-American family as a lead, but it wasn't 100% because we're black, this happened to us. Not at all. And I was really happy to see that.
So we're going to pause right here. There is more
pause.
Of this.
Pause. That was me hitting the pause.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just.
They can't see me do it, so I have to sound it out.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Well, okay, so we're pausing here. Darren's making the sound effect for pausing. But we will be back with this conversation. It'll continue on our next episode.
Yeah. We're going to keep along this deep dive. And so this is going to be a three-parter in terms of black horror. We're going to finish up the third part with Ganja and Hess and Get Out with Christina Leith-Mallon.